Hello, I'm Rosie Perez, and you're listening to Food Fridays with Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org.
There's an art to the business of opening a successful restaurant, and especially one here in New York. And my three guests here know a thing or two, or even three, about that subject. They are chef owners Gabrielle Hamilton of Prune on East 1st Street, Marcus Emerson of Red Rooster Harlem, Ginny's Supper Club and American Table Cafe, and Andrew Carmelini of Locanda Verde, The Dutch, and the upcoming Lafayette. And they all have books under their respective belts, which we will get to later. I'm very pleased to welcome them back to our show. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
In looking back now, are you more aware of the mistakes you made or the luck that played a part when you were starting out? Andrew?
Did you make mistakes?
Yeah. You had worked for other people.
I had
a sense of how the restaurant business worked.
Tend to make more mistakes than you make kind of successes, really, I feel. And that's, I ran restaurants for other people and made a lot of mistakes doing that. And then as an owner, there's continual... It's just adjustment every single day. It's a very organic business. It changes every single day.
Gabrielle, you're nodding your head.
I'm just thinking the only mistake I made was in opening a restaurant in the first place.
Are you regretting it now?
Oh, on the contrary. I don't mean that at all. It's just a joke. I love it.
But, I love the whole mistake is part of our industry. It's part of the process. And I think in order to be a good chef, it's really to get to know yourself, right? And in order to do that, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. You're going to probably make more mistakes than, like Andrew said, than successes. And then you hold on to those successes and just keep pushing it every day.
The key is not to hold on to the mistakes, though. You can't let those get at you.
Well, you don't even get a chance to make them anymore, it seems. The critical world is on you so fast that you don't get a chance to kind of be fallible in the beginning like you could pre-blog world and
Well, you say the critical world. There's also those Yelp things that are so ignorant. I read a review of a restaurant in Chicago that serves charcoal potatoes, and somebody complained, the potatoes were burned! So what do you do when they don't even understand what you're trying to do?
You have to stay the course.
Isn't one of the cliches of the business that the most important thing is location, location, location? What role does location play in the process? Marcus, what were you looking for?
To change and somewhat add to the footprint of dining. And, when you look at the map of Manhattan, there's below 96th Street, there's 22,000 restaurants, and there's very few restaurants in my community. And I felt there was an opportunity to add, and it would be... So, yeah, within that location was important. For me, it was important to have a restaurant in front of the bus stop and the subway station.
Well, you became a named chef at Aquavit in Midtown Manhattan, and you decided that Midtown was... I mean, you were doing well in Midtown.
Sure, but, having impact and doing well and... meaningfulness. This is meaningfulness for me. I think I was soul searching. I think I didn't know myself enough, and I felt, what could I add? We all are very different. We have this food thing, all three of us, but we're different individuals. And I think we're all, at least for me, I was searching. Working in Harlem, serving that community is something that's very meaningful to me.
Well, did you think that you'd be making Swedish meatballs up there?
I think as long as you make good Swedish meatballs, you can make them anywhere. They got to be yummy, delicious, and you got to have a narrative and an idea with it.
Gabrielle, you wrote in your memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, of how you stumbled upon a place that would become Prune, and it wasn't in good shape. So what was it about that location that spoke to you?
The rent.
Big factor.
Which is not an insignificant detail. I made the decision to invest as much in my sort of culinary endeavor as I ever had in my own education. So I thought, well, I've spent this much in student loans in my lifetime, and I'm willing to do the same for this education.
Well, that's why we've seen so many restaurants open the Lower East Side and then in Brooklyn. Although once the area becomes hot, then the rents go up, don't they?
Of course, for everyone else.
In 1999, did anyone think that East 1st Street was a good place to open a restaurant?
No. I went to Roberta's deep in Bushwick and had 10 years, 11 years later, the exact equivalent experience of what it must have felt like to come to Prune in 99. And you're sort of in the middle of nowhere. It feels very abandoned, derelict, covered in graffiti, shady characters on the sidewalk. And then you walk, you push back the door, and there you are in a place that actually has some serious food going on. And it was very exciting. So I think people were willing to suffer the vagaries and dangers of the East Village.
And now you are ahead of the curve. Now there's a whole bunch of places.
Yeah, now it's filled with money and underdressed women puking between cars at night.
Well, you make it sound so attractive. Andrea, you said that you're drawn in particular to corners. What is it about a corner that appeals to you?
I mean, there's something about traffic kind of going both ways and that visual kind of aspect. I really wanted a sense of neighborhood place at all the places. I mean, you don't necessarily have to have a corner, but there's something, the physicality of that, that has that stop by and grab a bite to eat kind of feel. And that's what I wanted to try to evoke at my places.
Danny Meyer says that traffic flow is an important factor when he's looking for a location. He wants to know that the traffic is moving, I guess, in the right direction for people to be let off at his restaurant.
Yeah, that's way more overanalyzed than I probably ever got, but that's...
Well, that's why he's such a failure.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, traffic flow, you know, important, but I think if you're doing a good product, people will come.
Well, didn't
I really believe in that.
Didn't all of you open your restaurants near where you lived? Is that important?
You Andrew? Know, walking to the restaurants, yeah, that's a good feeling. I can walk from La Conde to the Dutch to Lafayette probably in about 25 minutes.
Okay. Gabrielle, do you live down near your restaurant? Or you
used two to? Doors away. It's the greatest commute and also the worst one at the same time. You can sort of... All of New York City can evolve, and you've never seen it because you haven't been off your block in a year.
But what about the fact that you've decided to take a little time off? You're in your apartment, and suddenly you get that call. If you're living in Westchester, you could say, "Well, I'm sorry, I can't make it in. You'll have to take care of it yourself." But you're always on call, aren't you?
Oh, I sort of say, "Let them burn it down," whether I'm in Westchester or upstairs.
And Marcus, you live nearby?
I do. I live four blocks, and I couldn't do the restaurant without living close by because there's so much of the restaurant that comes of that community. And I waited 6 years before I opened the restaurant, so I had to learn a lot about what was that. I wasn't born in Harlem, so I just needed to walk and bike and learn a lot about the community.
Well, when you were looking for a place, are there certain things that you are non-negotiable in terms of layout, or is it fun to find a way to make a weird and quirky site work?
I mean, in this particular case, the subway was key for me. I wanted to have a conversation in front of the bus stop and the subway because also it brings a lot of people. But
street traffic is important.
And I've never thought about that before. You know, I'm coming from working in France and I never thought about the subway and the restaurant. But then also our building is an old building. You have a picture of how the building looked like 100 years ago, and it looks exact. It's fascinating to me every day how little has changed. I look at that building, it's like, wow, it was a beautiful building then, and it's a beautiful building now.
You know, to be a resident of the neighborhood in which you have a restaurant can really help you. Gives you some standing if you know what it's like to go up against a community board or in front of a community board, not necessarily against, but it can feel that way automatically. You take responsibility for your neighborhood and that your establishment is part of it in a healthy and productive way and not a destructive way.
Well, in your case, you were putting up a restaurant in rather tight quarters. New Yorkers often complain that they can't cook in their apartments because their kitchens are too small. And then I think about how small some restaurant kitchens are, and they seem to be able to turn out a lot of food.
Restaurants now are coming out of the backs of cars.
Well, you always figure it out. When you're faced with something in the restaurant, you have to figure it out. Doesn't matter if you have one burner or 30 burners. It has to happen.
I'm speaking with three great chefs today. Andrew Carmelini, Gabrielle Hamilton, Marcus Samuelson. They all have wonderful restaurants, and they're telling us what it takes to make a restaurant work in New York City on this Food Friday. Well, in your case, Andrew, you do have spaces that have large kitchens. Mm-hmm. Is that because you'd worked in restaurants where there had been large kitchens? When you work for Daniel Boulud, you never feel too constrained, do you?
I'm also working in them, so I'm probably a little bit more generous from a business side than I should be with how much space I give myself. That's because, I mean, I grew up in kitchens, so I'm approaching it as from a chef's, you know, standpoint. I've been very, very fortunate to have the funds to be able to do that too, which is, you know, a big part of it. I'm lucky.
Well, funds are important when you're starting. If you were, I'm sure people ask you all the time about opening restaurants. What is the thing that you warn them about first, Marcus?
Well, I think you have to get over, you know, you want to know the why, right? Because it's a commitment forever. It's hopefully, you know, it's something that is really deep and takes much, much more time and work than you ever can possibly think. So if it's just something that they think they want to be in, I think it's important. I think my first thing is, no, you don't. And I always really go back and like think about it. You don't want to open a restaurant. You should probably just go to restaurants. And if they still come back, then, you know. But going back to the whole, you know, living in the community that we work in, for example, and the community board, it's four blocks for me to work. But if the community board, you know, they helped before us, it was supposed to be four jails between those four blocks, right, between my restaurant and the fourth block.
Four jails,
exactly. But the community boards in those communities fought, and we got farmers market instead. That's a major difference, not just restaurant work, but how the whole thing will
because
work,
you have to
right?
be part of a food culture or a growing food culture.
So it sort of drives everything that so now we got to go out and support the farmers market. But I'm just saying, like, being in a community, living there, it drives every decision and why we're there.
Well, the three of you are chefs. And so you open up restaurants that reflect your ideas about food. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be that there are two kinds of restaurants. There are the kinds that you have, and there are the kinds where somebody wants to open up a restaurant and then often very late in the game hire somebody who then is supposed to put together a meaningful menu. They always strike me as being the ones that are more problematic.
I mean, a place has to have soul.
Well, I mean, would you ever, if somebody called you and said, Andrew, I'm opening up a restaurant, I'm not exactly sure what I want, but I think that I want to do Polish food. And and I think you're
I could do that. I'm half Polish.
Good.
My mom would be happy.
Yeah, but what is the soul that you're talking about there? You're not talking about filet of.
I mean, there's, you know, for a chef-driven restaurant, you're inserting your personality into it. You know, it's kind of like coming into your home. And I don't know. That's why I do it. I think otherwise it just becomes product. It just becomes concept, which works sometimes, and it works better sometimes than chef restaurants. I know it just has to have that feel to it. It has to have that juice.
You know, there are all these rules, right, that we're taught that your restaurant has to be in this location. It has to have this many seats to make money. You have to have a passion for the food. And then, of course, there are as many exceptions to the rules, the things that succeed, which shouldn't, and also the things that shouldn't succeed and do. And it flies in the face of all of the wisdom that we could possibly impart.
Is your personality reflected in Prune?
Mine is deeply.
Is that important to you?
Yeah, it's everything.
How is it?
It's the whole gestalt of the restaurant.
You mean the way it looks and the kind of food that you cook?
Oh, and the character of the food and the atmosphere and what the servers say and don't say and how we stand and don't stand and what we know and don't know. And sure, the whole shtick.
Does that get in the way? Does it drive your...
Well, when Martha Stewart went to jail,
right.
It became very evident very quickly that she needed to stop being the face of her business. I don't feel that way with Prune. Pretty sure it'll go on if I'm there or not.
My guests are Gabrielle Hamilton, chef owner of Prune at 54 East 1st Street. She's the author of Blood, Bones, and Butter, won the James Beard Award for writing and literature. Marcus Samuelson is the chef at Red Rooster Harlem, Ginny's Supper Club, American Table Cafe, and author of Yes, Chef, also from Random House. It's going to be out in paperback next month.
Absolutely.
And Andrew Carmelini is the chef at Locanda Verde, the Dutch, and the upcoming Lafayette. And he's the author of Urban Italian and American Flavor from Echo. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with our look at opening a restaurant, keeping it alive. And our three guests are Andrew Carmelini, Marcus Samuelson, and Gabriel Hamilton. Andrew, you worked under some pretty famous chefs, Greg Kunz at L'Espinasse before you went on to Le Cirque, and then worked for Daniel Blu at Café Blu. Was that good training for opening a restaurant as well as working in a kitchen?
You know, Daniel is he's a great chef. He's also a very good businessman. And that was a good training to kind of like do it for myself. You know, the art of cooking and the art of food is very, very different from the business of a restaurant. And I think, you know, from a cooking side, I mean, I'm a chef and that's what I wanted to be, was a really good chef. But the restaurant part's very different. So I'm still making those mistakes on the restaurant side. I have two very, very good working partners that help with that. But, you know, where those two intersect is often blurry lines.
Well, would you have even attempted opening your own if Robert De Niro hadn't approached you to reopen his restaurant in the Greenwich Hotel as Locanda Verde?
I was 2 weeks away from signing a lease on 10th Street to open a little pasta restaurant when Locanda Verde opportunity fell in my lap.
So luck does play a part in this whole story. Yeah. Gabrielle, you trained more outside of New York City, and then you did a lot of catering in New York. The subtitle of your book is The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. How would you explain that reluctance?
Well, I'm not trained at all, and I didn't know anything about running a restaurant before I opened one. I wasn't even a sous chef in a restaurant, let alone a chef of one, so I'm probably on this program to represent the small, independent, up by your bootstraps.
Do-it-yourselfer.
Literally, when the first customers came in, we were sort of like, oh, yeah, we're going to need change. Should we have pencils by the phone, maybe, to write down a reservation? It was total, hey, kids, let's put on a barn, a show in the barn.
Did you need a mentor to help you get past the reluctance?
No, the reason I'm reluctant is that sometimes this industry kind of fails me in a way. I sometimes wonder what the purpose and meaning is in cooking food
really?
Repeatedly. But when I opened the restaurant, that sense of purposelessness disappeared because it started to be about community and interpersonal human interaction, and food is just kind of the context.
Well, it's also about business, and it's also about
well,
noticing.
I'm here to represent the not-for-profit.
Noticing what people like eating. I assume that when you start, you have no idea whether certain dishes are going to take off and other ones are, even though you think that they should be really popular, are just not going to be ordered.
Right, but I mean, Prune, I'm so fortunate. I am the owner and the chef, and I don't I'm not thinking very much about what other people will like. Hopefully, this is the menu. This is how we do it. And we attract the kind of clientele that is most suited to us. And that's worked out for the past 13 years.
I don't think popularity comes in when you put in monkfish liver in the Lower East Side 2000. I don't think that's not the first thing that's going to pop.
But you did that anyway.
Well, that's what I grew up eating, that kind of thing, and made sense
and
to me.
And did people order it?
Of course, they flocked.
Yes. Yeah. In your case, Marcus, you have the most varied background. Orphaned in Ethiopia at the age of 3, adopted by the Swedish couple who encouraged your passion for food and cooking, and then you apprenticed in Switzerland, Austria, France. All good preparation for opening a place in Harlem?
Well, I mean, it's. I think going through some traditional cooking training, and it was the way I did, and in a very similar way actually to Andrew in that sense. You know, for me it was like always trying to go to France, and then you realize, well, I will never be French, which could be very obvious, you know. But that was like, I had to go to France, and I loved it. But
you must have learned stuff.
I learned a lot. I learned every single stop. I learned a lot, and I still think, again, it goes back to get to know yourself. And the rigid training was great. But I love always listening to Gabrielle because she's just such a great, refreshed reminder of how a chef can be, because we connect to her. You know, I just remember every time, which she does all the time when she wins this award, she goes up and speaks, and just it's like refreshing the whole room. Just like,
well, you know, something's up when you go to Prune and you see all these chefs on their night out at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. That has to be a big compliment to you. Marcus, did you always know that you would, that you wanted to wind up in the United States, in New York in particular?
Yeah, I think for me, I think being black just helped me in that state, because it was so clear that I couldn't work anywhere else. It was in France and in Switzerland, it was very clear that this was not a place where you could be a chef.
Really?
So those options, you know, sometimes your adversity helped. You know, I mean, if you ask, you know, the two things that were not in France was black chefs and women in the kitchen. And
well, now
I
one
learned,
of the top chefs in France is a woman.
Yeah.
But so maybe there's an opportunity for you. But don't go back.
No, I think a bit. So that clarity in that really helped me to be like, so I have to be somewhere where there's more diverse people. And I knew I could cook. And so I just needed to be somewhere with that. And, you know, I made that decision around when, you know, the Bensonhurst and all the stuff happened here in New York. But for me, it looked like, well, this is a very diverse place. So
it's so interesting if you think historically of the black writers and musicians who had to go to
France. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
To be known and famous and paid.
Yeah, exactly.
But then they went to restaurants where there were white chefs. My guests are Marcus Samuelson, Gabrielle Hamilton, and Andrew Carmelini. We're comparing notes on opening a restaurant and keeping it open. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Andrew, you credit your grandmother for playing an important role in your cooking. So
it's cliche, really.
You watched her?
It's true. I mean, both my grandmothers were good cooks and made things. My parents, too. They were, long before the word foodie existed, there were no restaurants. I mean, I grew up in South Cleveland. There were no great restaurants, really. There was no restaurant culture in the 70s. I mean, in general, there wasn't. But they wanted to eat things that weren't processed. They would go out of their way to get, like, go to the berry place because they didn't use pesticides.
Mm. Is this because they had European backgrounds?
You know, they're first-generation Americans. I think, I don't know where it came from. I don't know. I think they'd like to eat. And they didn't want, it was part of that 70s health food thing a little bit going on, you know. Some carob cookies once in a while in my childhood, which wasn't a good thing, but it was an important part of her family.
Hey, Gabrielle, was your mother a good cook?
My mother was an exquisite cook, more than domestic. I would say she's professional grade.
Mm-hmm. So some good cooks share that with their kids, and others don't. So you were lucky, your mother.
From my mother, I think she's also French, and from her, we and all of us, everyone in the family, inherited this very acute sense of kind of wartime food shortages and how to be very thrifty and how to use the whole animal and cure the cast iron and sharpen the knives and pick the fiddlehead ferns out of the forest and that kind of mentality. And my American father, sort of a dreamy artist. We learned a lot from him, too. Very valuable, equally, in a restaurant setting of generosity, hospitality. He could never cook for one. He could only cook for 100.
Mm-hmm. And you picked those fiddlehead ferns, and now foraging has become a new
another
aspect.
Cliche. Of,
yeah,
another cliche. There we go. It's unbelievable.
We talked about it last week on this show. Marcus, how did you discover you were interested in food? Because you did have an extraordinary childhood.
Well, I mean, it was similar. You know, my grandmother was a really good cook. And
your Swedish grandmother?
Yeah, my Swedish grandmother. And my mom was a horrible cook. So I just remember me and my sister used to eat half the dinner at home, then bike over to my grandmother's. And it just tasted different. You know, like the meatball were big and juicy. And, you know, the roasted chicken was so delicious. But so was the chicken soup the next day. And if you're real lucky, the chicken potato dumpling the third day. Mm. You know, so it's she made stuff. And that taste, that little sense of taste, I learned from her. And then on my father's side, they were fishermen. So going up there sometimes, it's like the smokehouse, right? There was always smoked mackerel. and you had to fish the mackerel and smoke it, and then we gave some away. So the sense of doing food was always in our tribe. It was something that we did, you know, and so it taught myself my taste buds.
I think you can tell in restaurants when that kind of person is behind the stove, that it's not conceptual, or they have a deep historic understanding of what they're preparing.
Well, does that affect the creation of the menu?
Absolutely.
I was talking earlier about two kinds of restaurants. There are some that just seem to be, okay, we're going to do what everybody else is doing right now, and we'll hire somebody to cook that food.
Right.
And then there are the restaurants that where you find things that you didn't expect, perhaps because of the foods that the chefs ate when they were young, or because you went to another restaurant and you said, gee, this is really interesting. Maybe I can do my own version.
Well, that's where the trends come, right, where you have meatballs everywhere, or you have, I don't know, the latest kind
pork of belly for a while.
You have the person who has the idea, and then you have the people who follow the idea, and then the people at the tail end of the idea when it's becoming the cliche and it's over.
It's funny that pork belly was a trend, or that would be called like a trend. Pork belly, we've been making
marrow.
Pork belly for
here's the difference. Short ribs were an inexpensive kind of meat that people did very nicely, wonderful cooking with. Now it's a very expensive cut of meat simply because half the restaurants in New York make some version of short ribs.
This is why we've returned to the filet mignon in our restaurant.
Good.
When we started out, the marrow bones were free. Our butcher gave them to us free. It's the same thing you gave your dog, and now they're $4.25 a pound.
Fish liver, too.
So how do you decide on pricing? Because you can't charge,
you can't charge
certain prices for really expensive cuts and have them be out of people's range. You just charge more for chicken and to make up for the fact that you can't charge as much.
You have to choose what you put on the menu. You have to choose your cuts and kind of where it comes from. And it's about balancing kind of everything. I mean, if you have that one item that's $52 on the menu, that's a lot, and it's a lot for people to see that when they have that on the menu. Even if it's amazing, people always pay for it.
Somebody will.
But I mean, split it for two.
Yeah, split it for two, and it's just you try to balance the menu appropriately.
Well, in your case, you even have gotten somebody to make a bean called the Carmelini bean, which turns out to be rather expensive.
It is rather expensive. That was a long time ago, though. I actually cannot afford Carmelini beans anymore.
So other people are cooking Carmelini beans.
I cannot. I can't. It's not at my restaurant.
What cuts of beef do you have on the restaurant right now, on the menus?
You know, the number one seller at the Dutch right now is hanger steak.
Mm-hmm.
Number one seller. You know, I have a higher-end dry-aged sirloin.
Uh-huh.
It's a dried sirloin. I felt if you were going to have an American restaurant, you have to have a really, really good sirloin cut. And hanger steak just outsells it. But it's twice the price.
And you have three restaurants. One is the Dutch is American. Mm-hmm. The Conde Verde is Italian. And now the Lafayette's going to be French.
Yes.
Will you be using the same kinds of ingredients and just doing different versions?
We've been spending a lot of time sourcing, doing different things. I mean, if we have black bass is really great right now, and I am going to have black bass at all the restaurants. It's also my favorite fish, just because I love it. So that's a thing that you can prepare in an Italian way, you can prepare it in the French way, and it's a great piece of fish, no matter what your style is.
And Marcus, you have a number of different places. Mm-hmm. Do you try to make the menus very different?
For me, it comes down to the narrative and the conversations you want to have. I mean, if you put things, the menu really tells right away the pricing that tells what conversation with the public do you want to have. So I think range is key. I decided right away that we should not be the editor telling people we should allow people to make their own choices in there. And I think if you have something for $4 on the menu, you can have something for $52 on the menu too.
Right.
And that's the difference from just fine dining, where everything is sort of curated, edited, and almost to the point of who do you want to come into the restaurant? That has changed completely.
Do you have a say as to how the wait staff approaches the customers? I mean, do you train them?
Yeah, training is hard.
100% say.
Yeah, I mean, I do. You know, does training only go so far because everyone kind of likes to to insert their personality.
Can you tell
bit,
them not to come up to the table and say, "How are we doing?" Or
Trust me.
Are
you finished working on this?
It's my all-time, like, that drives me crazy. But are you done working on this?
Yes. I feel like it's
a
job.
It was such a chore.
Bring out the hammer and the nails. Gabrielle, are you tempted to open another restaurant?
I'm not.
Just one
honest
thing.
Honest truth. There it is.
They say that the way you can tell if a restaurant is a success is if it remains open after the first lease has expired. Do landlords try to hike up the rent if you have a hot place?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what do you do? At a certain point, do you have to decide, well, okay, I can't make it work if I'm paying that much money a month?
I haven't been. I have 15 more years to go, so I'm not in that position.
Sign a long lease is the trick, right?
Sign a long lease is your trick.
But it's always in the back of your head, what if, I remember when we had to move Aquavit from one location to another location, it's nerve-wracking and we started to save basically 5 years before that, just really, when we have to move. And I don't think I did that transition well. I think I was always a 54th Street guy, not 55th Street guy. I love that townhouse,
Well, it was right across the street from the Museum of Modern Art. It was a wonderful location. Just one more thing. The Lafayette's opening next week?
If everything goes well.
Restaurants never open exactly when it's supposed to.
Well, it was supposed to open in November, so. Last November, yeah. If everything goes well, which it never does, next week sometime we'll throw the doors open and hope people show up. It's always the fear, right?
We're out of time, but is it important to write a book? Because all three of you have written books.
No, it's important to be on TV.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about that later with Emily Nussbaum.
That's really where the how you get the people in your seats is the television.
Well, we're very pleased that you decided to come on radio today, and we thank you all.
I look much better.
Gabrielle Hamilton of Prune, Marcus Samuelson of Red Rooster Harlem, Ginny's Supper Club, American Table Cafe, and Andrew Carmelini of Locanda Verde, the Dutch, and the soon-to-open, months late, Lafayette. Thank you all for being on our show.
Thanks for
having us.